Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Alex Lawson, Executive Director of Social Security Works, who talks about the U.S. healthcare crisis that will intensify next year due to the exponential rise in health insurance costs and likely result in 51,000 preventable deaths. Dr. John Gartner, a psychotherapist, author, and founder of the group Duty to Warn, who assesses the danger President Trump's dysfunction and cognitive decline poses to the nation and the world. And Mahmoud Khalil, the Columbia University graduate student who was arrested by ICE agents in March, discusses his pending legal cases and his lawsuit seeking accountability for the Trump regime's drive to suppress Palestinian rights activism in the U.S. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A day after Bashar al-Assad's regime in Syria fell last December, the Israeli army crossed over the border from the occupied Golan Heights into the southern part of the country. 1 year later, Israeli forces continue to occupy southern Syria, and the frequency of Israeli military raids on towns is increasing. Israel's invasion of the town of Beit Jinn in late November left at least 13 Syrians dead, including two children. Israeli officers have told Syrian residents their presence is solely meant to prevent armed groups from operating on the border. But the IDF's increased military activity has left residents wondering how long life under occupation will continue. Syria's government has made multiple appeals to the international community to end the Israeli occupation, a violation of a 1974 UN Security Council resolution establishing the buffer zone between Syrian forces and the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights. In contrast, Syria's new government is actively cooperating with the U.S. military in northeast Syria to flush out ISIS and other extremist groups. On December 13th, a joint U.S.-Syrian patrol was attacked by what was claimed to be an ISIS gunman near the city of Palmyra, killing two U.S. service members and one American civilian interpreter. The ambush also injured three U.S. soldiers and two Syrian fighters. For months, Venezuelan military forces have tracked tin and coltan mineral traffickers backed by Colombian guerrilla groups and chased them into Colombia's Amazon River basin. Massive and destructive illegal mining of rare earth minerals in the region followed a recent spike in demand for these elements that are critical to the manufacture of electric vehicles, high-tech electronics, and advanced military weaponry. As Western countries seek to diversify their dependence for rare earth minerals away from Chinese dominance, buyers from China are increasingly accessing materials from regions with weak regulatory oversight, including the Colombian-Venezuelan border area. The illegal mining activity comes at a time when U.S. President Donald Trump has deployed a large U.S. naval armada off the coast of Venezuela and almost daily threatens to use these forces to remove Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro from power. On December 10th, Trump further escalated tensions by ordering the seizure of a Venezuelan oil tanker in the Caribbean Sea. With little notice, the Trump administration is handing out hundreds of billions of dollars in tax cuts to some of the country's most profitable companies and wealthiest investors. The Treasury Department and Internal Revenue Service, through a series of notices and proposed regulations, are giving tax breaks to giant private equity firms, crypto companies, foreign real estate investors, insurance providers, and a variety of multinational corporations. These tax breaks come in addition to nearly $4 trillion in tax cuts that President Trump signed into law in July. The New York Times reports that Trump is rapidly eliminating the alternative minimum tax law passed by Democrats in 2022, intended to ensure that some of the nation's most profitable corporations pay at least some federal income tax. The aggressive actions of the Trump regime has raised alarm that it is likely exceeding its legal authority to bypass Congress, which the Constitution empowers to determine and enact tax law. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
With the Republican-controlled House and Senate's failure to extend federal subsidies for the Affordable Care Act health insurance program, 24 million ACA or Obamacare enrollees will see their monthly premiums double on average beginning on January 1st, causing as many as 5 million policyholders to lose their health care coverage. The Republican Party, which has voted to eliminate the ACA more than 60 times since 2010, has repeatedly promised to propose an alternative federal health insurance program, but never has. Instead, President Trump and GOP legislators passed a budget in July that cuts over $1 trillion from Medicaid and Medicare, the largest rollback in health care funding in U.S. history. It's estimated these cuts will result in 10 million people losing their health insurance coverage when the new budget takes effect in December 2026. 4 million Americans will also lose access to SNAP food and nutrition benefits. These cuts will benefit the nation's top 1% wealthiest households with over $1 trillion in tax cuts over the next decade, the largest transfer of wealth from the bottom to the top in American history. Your reporter spoke with Alex Lawson, executive director of the group Social Security Works, who talks about the U.S. healthcare crisis that will intensify next year, due to the exponential rise in health insurance costs, loss of federal support for hospitals, leading to many closures, especially in rural America, and rising medical debt. He also discusses potential solutions to repair the nation's broken healthcare system.
If you take people's healthcare away, more people will get sick. People will get sicker. People will die. And people will go bankrupt. So that's what we can expect. Around 5 million people are going to lose their health insurance because they'll no longer be able to afford it because the Republicans refuse to prevent the premium spikes that are already happening. And as you noted, an average doubling of insurance premiums, doubling. It's never happened before that so many Americans have faced such enormous increases in their health care costs, in their health insurance costs. So we know what's going to happen. The failure to stop the premium spikes in Obamacare will lead to people dying. And you have to layer that on top of the $1 trillion that the Republicans have cut from Medicaid. That's done. That's not in the future. That has happened. And so we're already seeing hospitals closing or cutting back services. Usually emergency rooms and maternity wards are the first on the chopping block. And this destruction is just rolling across the country right now. Everyone will get hurt, but it will especially impact people in rural areas. It'll impact older folks. It'll kill and harm disproportionately the most vulnerable in our society. So the oldest of the old, seniors with disabilities, poorer seniors. And what we're talking about, the models for just the Medicaid side is around 51,000 preventable deaths a year from this $1 trillion cut. And that number is going to increase when you add in the 5 million who lose their coverage because they can no longer afford it because the Republicans refuse to prevent the premium spikes. It's really important for people to remember, why did they do this? Why are people going to die? Why are we seeing the largest transformation of our healthcare system since Medicare? All so that the Republicans could give trillions of dollars in tax handouts to billionaires, literally the richest people in the history of the world, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, those billionaires who sat behind President Trump when he was sworn in. You know, he was showing who he's working for. And you know what? He's working for them extremely hard. The billionaires are making out, and the working people in this country are going to pay the price with our health, our well-being, and in too many cases, our lives.
And Alex, an increasing number of Americans are dissatisfied or horrified with the U.S. healthcare system. Many think it's completely broken. Is this a moment, in your view, in U.S. politics where proposals for universal healthcare could gain traction, such as the long-running proposal to institute a Medicare for All program, a single-payer program, like much of the rest of the developing world has had for decades?
I think we are approaching a unique spot where it will be possible. But unfortunately, we have to deal with the reality of our system. President Trump is going to be president for his entire term. And this is not a guy who's going to extend healthcare to anybody. So we do need to be preparing and working every day to transition to guaranteed healthcare for every person in this country. You get sick, you get the care that you need. No premium, no deductible, no prior authorizations, no AI robot denials. You know, none of this happens in any other country other than ours. Some of the stuff that really needs to be happening right now is that states are going to be on the hook for enormous health insurance losses. You know, you take California and Washington and Oregon, and they're looking at the federal government pulling back. And some of these states are going to step up, and they're just going to look at the arithmetic and say, it actually makes more financial sense for our states to offer a single-payer state-based system, then they can do multiple states, and then maybe we can bring that out to the entire country. That's how single-payer was achieved in Canada, and I think that is a good model for us to follow right now. We're never going to stop fighting for Medicare for All at the federal level, but I do think that there is a lot of interesting and really important work happening at the state level as well.
That was Alex Lawson, executive director of the group Social Security Works. Learn more about the causes and possible solutions to address America's healthcare crisis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Donald Trump, the oldest person in American history to be inaugurated as president, is increasingly showing signs of cognitive decline. His speeches, social media posts, and interactions in the Oval Office are now often characterized by disjointed thoughts, rambling, incoherent responses to questions, and angry tirades that have called for the execution of political opponents, labeled an entire ethnic group as garbage, and regularly hurls personal insults at White House reporters. In his second term, Trump has been observed sleeping during cabinet meetings, walking aimlessly during trips abroad, and exhibited confused behavior in various settings. After a man collapsed in the Oval Office on November 6th, the president stood up, turned away from the frantic efforts to aid the man, stared blankly straight ahead, and appeared frozen or catatonic. Dr. John Gartner, a psychotherapist and author, warns that Mr. Trump's more frequently observed bizarre behavior are symptoms that point toward a personality disorder exacerbated by unmistakable signs of dementia. Your reporter spoke with Dr. Gartner, founder of the group Duty to Warn, that brought together mental health professionals that issued warnings about the impending peril of Trump's presidency. Here he talks about the danger Trump's dysfunction and cognitive decline poses to the nation and the world, and questions about who in the White House is now actually making decisions for the country.
We know that these behaviors are part of diagnostic syndromes that are very, very dangerous. And it's right there in front of our eyes. And really, the media has been sort of gaslighting us by acting as if this is somehow some, you know, either unknowable thing or only irresponsible, unethical psychologists would be making these wild statements. Even if you're not a professional, you can see that these are incredibly destructive and damaging behaviors. Now what we're seeing, though, is a collision of his personality disorder with his ongoing, I think, very clear signs of dementia. And when people develop dementia, if they have any kind of personality disorder or personality problem, they become dramatically worse. Whatever their personality disorder is, it becomes dramatically worse. It becomes more aggressive, more impulsive, more disinhibited, more disorganized. And that's what we're seeing here. He's still the same sick, destructive person, but now it's becoming completely impulsive and confused.
Dr. Gardner, just recently we've seen Donald Trump lash out at an entire community, the Somalians living mm-hmm. in Minnesota, basically mm-hmm. calling them every name in the book. He's also yeah. called for the execution of Democratic legislators who informed yeah. military service people that they should not follow or obey illegal orders. And then just the other day, after the apparent homicide involving Rob Reiner, the movie director, and his wife, Donald Trump yeah. said in one of his social media posts that Rob Reiner died because he was critical of Trump. I wondered if you would just talk about some of the other examples and what your major concern is about someone like Donald Trump, who uniquely in the world has the nuclear codes to the world's deadliest arsenal of nuclear weapons.
We really have reason to be utterly terrified. This really is kind of the worst case scenario. We kind of have a mad king, but a mad king with dementia, and a mad king with dementia who has the absolute power to destroy the world and kind of the temperament to do it. We're seeing now, because of the dementia and because he has so much power, the combination of the two is he's acting out in all of these incredibly destructive ways. You know, we always knew he was a racist, but demonizing a whole ethnic group in extended terms, expressing itself in more primitive ways and in ways where he's more inclined to just impulsively go into action. You know, he's the American Hitler by personality, right? So we understand why he would want to, you know, jail his critics and, because that's what fascists do. And he has the fascist personality disorder. But also now because he's become so cognitively declined, it's expressing itself in these ways that are so grotesque and so inappropriate and so bizarre. And this is only going to get worse. I always say to people, look at Donald Trump today, because that's the best Donald Trump you're ever going to see, because we're talking about a deteriorating illness. But the problem is as he's deteriorating, no one is stopping him.
Dr. Gardner, in talking about all of Trump's dysfunction, the question arises, who's in charge of our government? A lot of people are concerned that somebody like Stephen Miller, who's very mm-hmm. close to the president and is, I think, the primary responsible person in the White House for a lot of both the domestic and foreign policy decisions. I don't expect that you or I could know who really is in charge, but what's the danger in that?
Well, they used to say in the Middle Ages, a bad king is better than no king, but no king is better than a child king. Because with a child king, you just have all this internecine warfare and, you know, court politics and wars, and it's just total chaos. It is very dangerous to have a leader who's slipping and then having other people around them sort of assuming covert power. Stephen Miller, I think, is the greatest threat. I think he's insane. I think he is truly a Nazi. I think he's like channeling, Goebbels in a way that's like psychotic. And he wants to terrorize the immigrants in the cities. I mean, really, this is like Kristallnacht. There's a reign of terror going on in this country, right? ICE is essentially, what is it, these masked thugs breaking windows, wrestling people to the ground? I mean, this is a true reign of terror. This is Stephen Miller. Okay, and then there's Russell Vought, who just wants to completely destroy the federal government. And he's doing that piece by piece. So, yeah, Trump is sort of, you know, delegated to these guys. I can't imagine a more destructive duo right now.
That was Dr. John Gartner, a psychotherapist, author, and founder of the group Duty to Warn. Find links to Dr. Gartner's commentaries on his observations regarding Donald Trump's cognitive decline by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Mahmoud Khalil, the Columbia University graduate student who was arrested by ICE agents on March 8th outside his New York City apartment, spoke at the Palestine Museum U.S. near New Haven, Connecticut, on November 22nd. This was his first trip outside of New York City since a judge lifted severe travel restrictions. He's now free to travel the country to speak about his ordeal and his fight against the Trump administration's targeting of foreign students and other people whose political views they oppose, especially pro-Palestinian activists. After his arrest, Khalil was held in an immigration jail in Louisiana for 3 months and 3 days before being granted bail. During his incarceration, he missed the birth of his son. Khalil served as a negotiator and spokesperson for the Columbia Student Gaza Solidarity Encampment in April 2024, which demanded that the university call for a ceasefire in the Gaza war and divest from companies linked to Israel that profited from the Gaza genocide. The event at the Palestine Museum featured a conversation between Khalil and Stanley Heller, chair of the Connecticut-based Middle East Crisis Committee and sponsor of Khalil's appearance. He began by describing his court cases both as a plaintiff and a defendant.
So I have so many now legal cases, unfortunately. So the most recent one from yesterday is actually, it's a lawsuit against the administration to reveal its, I would say, collision and conspiring with pro-Israeli groups like Canary Mission, Bitar, Worldwide, the other Colombia actors who worked with the government to smear Palestinian activists around the country, to smear Palestinian speech in this country. And we believe that the public deserves to know about these connections, how these connections happened, because all these groups were announcing that they were collaborating with the federal government to squash the Palestine movement in this country. And here it's part of the effort to expose Project Esther, and a project that's meant to use different obscure laws in the U.S. to come after Palestinian activism in this country and how they can conflate anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. That's, I think, the essence of Project Esther, how they can demonize Palestinian speech and fabricate stories about this speech. So this is one of the lawsuits that hopefully will contribute to showing these connections between the administration and these shady groups.
So what about the cases against you? They grabbed you off the street and put you in an ICE jail in Louisiana, and then there was a victory in that you were released on bail, but then there was an immigration court decision and then a counter. So tell us about that.
I mean, it's so complicated, but I will try to give the simple version of there is a kangaroo court called an immigration court. It's fully controlled by the executive branch. They're not real judges. It's not a real process. Literally, the attorney general controls that process. And I'm saying this because, as even an immigrant myself, but also I realize that the most of the public here, they don't know anything about the immigration system in this country, how the executive branch can manipulate that system. And when we hear that it is like court, it's immigration judge, that we think that it is a real process, but it's not. So that process, because it's fully controlled by the administration, they've decided that I am deportable from the United States based on the Rubio determination first, but then when a federal judge said this is unconstitutional, you cannot use this. Then they brought alleged, like, they call it fraud charges about my green card application, which was approved a year before, and there isn't any fraud whatsoever. So now we're also fighting that. The real case is in New Jersey, a federal case. It's called habeas, which is a First Amendment case. We're saying that the Trump administration was motivated by political reasons to deport me, basically to chill speech across the country, which they partially succeeded, unfortunately, in literally like fear-mongering and punishing others so that whether students or not, whether citizens or immigrants or anyone in this country would fear speaking for Palestine. When we got the bail, the administration immediately appealed that decision to the appeal court, and the appeal court basically rejected their first argument, but now we're waiting to hear a decision from the appeal court as well. And the other case, which is I'm also suing the administration for damages for $20 million for malicious prosecution and for false imprisonment and for defamation, for calling me all these names without any sort of evidence. So that's also is ongoing. And the main purpose of that is just to seek accountability. Because this administration, I mean, they figured they can do whatever they want. They can just throw pasta on the wall and see what sticks and what not, because there's no accountability whatsoever. So we have to make them feel that there is accountability for everything that they are doing. It's not just a court order and that's it. They have to feel that there is consequences for their actions. And these lawsuits are just a small part of that effort. But the bigger effort is by actually the community, the people actually raising against this administration to make it pay for all the wrongdoing that they've been doing recently.
That was Mahmoud Khalil, the Columbia University graduate student who was arrested by ICE agents in March, speaking at Connecticut's Palestine Museum US on November 22nd. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. Learn more about Khalil's ICE arrest, pending legal cases and lawsuits, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WERU in East Orland, Maine, KPSQ in Fayetteville, Arkansas, KYRS in Spokane, Washington, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.